reality you're selling every time, because when you are in the corporate world, you're pitching sales, you're pitching to climb the ladder. When you are presenting to a CEO or to a board, you are selling your knowledge, what they are paying for. So you are always selling.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy, the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing SMB spend without buying ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Victor Lanton from Compass Planning Group. Now, I am rolling up. I'm closer to 50 than I would like to be. And I sometimes wonder what would happen to me. They often say, you know, your 40s, your 50s are your peak years. And I sometimes wonder what would happen if I had to start all over again. In fact, sometimes I think it might be a dream. I wake up in the middle of the night and worry about it. And I don't know of anyone who gets to a certain stage in the career who doesn't have that thought. But today I'm speaking to Victor Lanton, and he's someone who actually did this, and he managed to reach the heights of his chosen career in Venezuela and then had to start all over again today. And we're going to talk about how he managed to do that, how he started from scratch. We're going to talk about the sort of clients he now works with as a fractional CFO. And if you are building a fractional CFO business yourself, he's going to share some of the insights and some of the systems he's used to help build up that practice. So, Victor, you're very welcome to the show. Maybe you could just start us off by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Thank you, James, for the invitation. Something that too many people don't know. I am from Venezuela, as you mentioned, but I grew up in a little island called Margarita Island. And actually, I grew up in another town that is called Maracay, which is 150 kilometers from the capital, Caracas, and grew up in a family with religious principles and all the thing of a family. And then I had to move from Maracay to Margarita and then spend many years there. And then went to university in Caracas, no, where are the top universities in Venezuela. But when you grew up in an island, you learn how to surf, to windsurf, to many things that a lot of people dream about it, but it's something that you have a beach 24/7 whenever you want. So you can sneak out of the school and go to the beach, and it was a very fun time.
Very good. So you ran away from the beach to join the corporation. So the opposite way that people normally think about it.
Yeah, you should.
All right. Awesome. So let's get interested. Let's first set things out. So you had a successful career in Venezuela. Maybe you could just tell us about, bring us up to your, from your 20s up to your 40s, how you managed to climb in terms of the corporate ladder.
Thank you for asking that. I have to go back a lot. Probably if I cry, please forgive me about it. But I started very early working. I was a passionate of work on my summer breaks from at high school. I started to work with my dad, and he has a foreign exchange company. Uh-huh. And then when I went out of high school and went to Caracas, my dad told me, please focus on college. And I started my career in 2 or 3 years after, on my midterm of college, on the half of my career, I started with PepsiCo, and I started from scratch, data entry, a clerk, bring this here, bring that to that. But it was the time that internet was starting. It was in 1993, 94. So I saw in the corporate world when PowerPoint was one slide, one file, because we didn't have video beams or stuff like that. So I started from that level. And then I started to become a supervisor and then manager. And then I got into senior management in PepsiCo for around 12, 13 years. Then I moved. I decided to stop down after 13 years. You feel burned out. And I started to do my master in economics. And then while I was studying, I went to work for General Motors for a little bit, managing the after sales operations for them. And then I moved back. I went to the Citibank, so another industry. So I started to feel curious about industries, because a lot of my friends started in Procter and spent like 10, 20 years in Procter and doing the same stuff. I never feel comfortable on a fixed position like accounting. I like to learn a lot. So then I went to the industry of banking, and then from banking I went to one of my clients invited me on I was in Citibank, and one of my clients invited me to go work with them, and I went to the technology industry with Motorola. So it was a kind of growing through every, you know, time that I move, it was a scaling a position. And then I came back when Motorola had a crisis that they spun off and they separate mobile devices and they started to lay off people. I went back to PepsiCo like a bailout, and I was the, let's say, the CFO for Venezuela and Colombia. But at that time, I had to travel too much, like 90% of my time I was traveling, and my daughter just was born at that time, and I had to jump in. And I went back to the technology industry with a company called Brightstar that they changed the name several years ago. That was the largest distributor of mobile devices and technological stuff for Venezuela, in the world, actually. They were big in the world. And working there, started to the economical things and the political things in Venezuela started to complicate in 2014.
Let me just jump in there before we get onto that. One of the great benefits of having a fractional CFO is you get to ask dumb questions that you're supposed to know, and then you get an answer. Because we're going to touch on food services or food businesses later. So PepsiCo, like we all know that as a drink you buy in shelves, but what's the extent of that business? Is it literally, is it the sugar water, or is there, what scope does it encompass? What sort of products and what sort of supply chain is involved?
Actually, in reality, in PepsiCo, I worked in beverage quite some time. And yes, the business at that time is more marketing and the secret sauce, the concentrate that actually one is in Ireland. One of the biggest, largest concentrate plant of PepsiCo is there in Ireland, in Cork. But I spent many years with Frito-Lay, which is the snacks business, the fruit business. And over there, I focus on the finance part, financial planning, and then supply chain finance and strategy. So I spent many growing there, and regarding supply chain, I start with the procurement department. You had to deal with the agricultural, because you had to make sure that you're growing the potatoes and the corn for the chips. And so you have to take into account that is a whole world. And also the other suppliers, like the oil, also the water, and if you locate the manufacturing plant where you don't have water and you have to invest in huge tanks, and that's not affordable. So it was a pretty nice challenge. And I was, on top of that, I was across all LATAM from, let's say, the south part of, let's say, from Guatemala, the border of Mexico, because I was whole Latin America except Mexico and Brazil, that they were like a complete region. I was in that side, in that part of Latin America. So I spent time in Central America. I spent time in the South Cone of South America and also in Colombia. So I traveled a lot during that time.
Very good. And a CFO in a brand name like that, like sounds like a pretty, you must have been one of the business leaders in the country at this stage. I'm guessing you were used to living a fairly comfortable life with business class flights and all the accoutrements of a team like that. And most people, if they could get to that level, they put a fork in it. Okay, I've reached the top more or less, and this is what I'm interested in. So to step away from that, I don't want to get too political, but I would like to get it from a human perspective, like from your family, to make a decision to step away that and change countries. What were the motivators that made you decide to take that leap?
Well, James, it was a real tough decision. Okay. It was my, you are resigning to a lot. First, your country, and everybody has that patriotism inside, no? Like, you want to be in your country, you love your country. It's rare to have someone that really don't like your country, no? Even if it's a poor country or whatever, it's where you belong, no? Sure. But in my case, I started to have conflict with the government because I thought differently, more freedom and stuff like that. But I had to resign to all the perks. When you are in Latin America and you are in those levels, you get the benefits of having a car, or a SUV, with sometimes with chauffeur, with drivers. You get to have help at home when you are in those positions, your country club, your golf membership. So you have a lot of benefits that you have to put in a balance that you can continue with that, but with a high risk of leaving and make a decision that is that the right choice for your family, or, well, hit the reset button and flow away. But in my case, it was a force because I was, let's say, harassed by some government personalities that were my neighbors, because they were saying that the rich guys, I wasn't rich, but they, everybody that had a nice job or a nice car for them was rich, but they became our neighbors. So for them, the money was good, but it's a hypocrisy of that system, no? I describe this system that they break your legs for you to give thanks for the crutches. For you to thank them for giving you the crutches, no? But they broke your legs, no? So it's a matter of that decision that you have to risk it all, but feeling free that even though that you have to work hard or do a lot of stuff there, if you move, whatever you go, is the United States, Europe, or South America, or any other country, you have to start from scratch. But the other thing is that you are thinking about you're safe, that trying to avoid not going to jail for thinking different.
I can empathize. I can see, like, in developing economies, to a certain extent, this is in my own family. We started my family in South Africa, and South Africa is a wonderful country. But then kids came along, we had a choice, and there's a security situation in South Africa, which is very unfortunate. And that sort of impacted our decision to move away. I wish it wasn't the case, because it's a fantastic country and we go back there all the time and I love it. When it comes down to it, when your kids are involved, you're like, it's suddenly your tolerance goes to zero, right? Yeah. Correct. But it sounds like this is one more step. So it's a situation where you really were forced out. It doesn't sound like you were, it's not like you made all your money and can just live abroad. You moved to Florida and then you had to more or less start from building from the startup. So what was your first job, if you like, or how did you start to make a living going from business class flights and maids and chauffeurs, turn up in Florida, first month rent is due? What did you do?
I had a little bit of money saved. It's important to have savings when you do this. We didn't have too much time to plan, like 1 month or 2 months to plan it. So what I did at the very beginning, imagine from being an employee all my life to start from zero, and then you, let's say, start a business. But even though you have managed a business, you don't have a clue how to start a business, because there are two different animals. A lot of people think that, oh, but you're a CFO. Yeah, but start a business is a whole story than working or building up a business, no? So I started my first consulting firm over there and here in Miami. I registered my company and I started to, okay, now what? I did a business plan. So what should I do? What should I offer? Because I have many knowledge, but I don't know no one. I know a few friends here and there that you get to know, I don't know, at church or something like that, but they're in the same case than you. They are arriving, they are starting up, they are in the same boat. So it's one of the key learning that I had to learn was the hard way, is networking and start reaching out to people that you have probably 10, 20 years without seeing them, and then move to start reading books and stuff like that to get educated on how to start a business, no? So I partnered at that time with a friend of mine, and we started to do some few things, financing or doing some supply chain financing and stuff like that, but didn't work out. Then I hooked up like 4 or 5 months after with a Greek yogurt company, and I did some consulting on creating a forecast model because they had some supply chain issues. So I came in on board and helped them, but it was a startup and they didn't have too much money to work with. And I had to start from scratch. Now when Uber was starting, so I started to do Uber, and now that I had Uber and I had the time, I went to work in a warehouse, grabbing bags and moving bags from one side side and another. And then I ended up at that warehouse helping the warehouse manager. You have a workflow thing, you have a constraint here. And all of the sudden, I was jeopardizing the job of that warehouse manager. And I feel bad. And then this Greek yogurt company called me back. I started there, but making a penny of a dollar, not the salaries, because it was a startup. And then I helped another startup here in the United States, even though we know the whole stories of the success stories of Facebook and the startups like Uber, stuff like that. But there are a lot. I want to say a huge percentage is around 60% of those startups that they cannot make it the first year. And that's huge, no? So I started to help immigration attorneys for the immigration investment visas. Those visas require a business plan. So I started to build business plans. I was doing, let's say, one business plan every 1 or 2 months. And it was $1,000 business plan or $2,000 business plan, but that wasn't enough to pay the bills. So then with the Uber, a full-time Uber, but I destroyed 2 cars. Not that I crashed. It's in reality is you put in 1 year 200,000 miles to a car. In reality, you are destroying the car. No, because it's designed to make probably 15 in a year. But, and it wasn't that, it was a very good cash maker, but not profitable at all, because when you have to change a tire, you don't have enough margin to react.
That's what Uber is famous for, right? They use the capital of their employees to run their business, and they don't really factor in all these other costs. Most of them don't. And then they just go out of business, but it doesn't matter. More people come on and there's just churning people all the time who are all losing money.
No, and the reality is, is that when I got my first 1099, the tax document, they put me that I made so much of money and they put their gain, you know, what they invoice there. And I had, wait a minute, in my bank only came the half and this is not real. So I had to, okay, what happened here? Okay, I had my company and I had to put, okay, this is the fees and all the stuff that they charge and this is my net. Now we're talking. That one I met with a friend of mine and he told me, Victor, you play golf, right? And I said, yeah, I play golf. And he said, why don't you get a golf caddy job? And I said, golf caddy? For me, I had a golf caddy in Venezuela when I was a member of a country club. I didn't see myself in caddying golf, but in reality it was the best job I ever had. It was so fun. You're doing something that you like. You get to know a lot of people. Even for networking was great. Unfortunately, when I had to leave it, I was a financial advisor, and by regulation, I couldn't do that because it was a gold mine. It was a gold mine because I was caddying for people with billions of dollars. So I went to one of the most prestigious club here in Miami, and I golf caddy for 3 seasons. For 3 years, I was a golf caddy during the season. Okay, the season is from November to March and to April because it's when the heat start to pop up. But it was an amazing, it's hard. If I was 21 or 25, it was a good exercise and stuff like that. But when you are 45 or 46 or 44, I don't remember now, carrying a bag or be running around raking in sand. But you know, it was the most profitable job that I had, and I enjoy it. And the perk was that I got to play on those beautiful golf courses for free. So it was part of my perks. So whenever I had the chance, I got to play, and that in my civil life, I couldn't afford to pay a green fee or something like that. And I was playing for free in a $400 green fee golf course. So it was amazing.
I love it. It's interesting you say it was the best job you've ever had, even considering all the dream jobs you had before, but maybe didn't pay the best, but it was like, yeah. But you found it quite lucrative compared to the Uber driving for sure, right? So this is a more specialized skill.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But it's a job that, and when I say the best job, When things align with your values and stuff like that, you have a purpose and align with your values, you can stay and work for that. I can go tomorrow to work as a golf caddy at that club again, if I have to start again. And people will say, go back to golf caddy. It's something that you do, that you like. You're doing a service. You're working with people and you get in connection with people. And is in another level. It's like you have 4 hours of talking or having a conversation with a CFO or a CEO of a company. So it's a good time to networking. When you're an Uber driver, you have many drives and you can even go to good places, but it's so random. And yeah, you can network there. It's like hitting a lotto, it's complicated.
Yeah, okay. So someone had to spend $400 to get to network with you before. So it's a forcing function.
Yeah, and you get paid.
You're going to get paid. Okay, so you're not working at the golf club anymore, which means you got out of that. And I want to talk to you. I know you're a bit like myself into continuous development. I talked before the show about Tony Robbins and others, which I'm a big fan of. But there's one system in particular you found. Now, sales is a thing that finance professionals doesn't come naturally to them. Just like me, I'm a programmer, something you have to learn. But you found a system that has helped you to develop your practice. Maybe you could tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, and in reality, I forgot, and I have the book on my bookshelf. Yeah, sales is not part of my DNA in reality, because my DNA is finance, numbers, and operations, supply chain stuff. And when you come here and you start a business, sales is critical. I think that I spend more time trying to sell or trying to get prospects, because still for me is a limitation that the lead generation is part of the process. Okay. So I had to learn the skill, because the good thing is a skill and you can learn it. It's not something when people say I hate sales, that they put their limitation. In reality, you're selling every time. Because when you are in the corporate world, you're pitching sales, you're pitching to climb the ladder, to when you are presenting to a CEO or to a board, you are selling your knowledge, your what they are paying for. So you're always selling. The problem is the process. And I came across, I was starting my financial advisory gig. It was one that I became a financial advisor for one large financial advisory company here in the United States. They introduced me or brought me in some of the trainings, a book called You Can Teach to Ride a Bike, a kit at a seminar that is from David Sandler. And it's an introduction to the Sandler sales system. And when probably there are many methodologies and the cold calling and all those stuff that I really hate. What I like of this book is that align with my principles, that you get to decide if you're going to work with someone or not. That you as a salesman, you have that choice as well, than only to the goal of just making a sale. Yeah, you need to sell, but sometimes when you are dealing with someone that is not aligned with your purpose or is not aligned with your principles or your kind of your values, you ended up, some of the both parties is going to screw it up. And sorry for my French, and is going to mess it up and is going to break. That is not going to be, it's not sustainable. But when you align your client with your values and your purpose, that's is going to be a long-term relationship. That's why I really like that system, because it's nurturing and having that relationship and continue doing the sales. And those guys refer you more clients, and probably the people that they are inviting for you to help them, you're going to say no. And that's one note that I learned from that book, is that sometimes in the first meeting, and a lot of people criticize me, and I say, look, in this first meeting, I'm not going to sell. I'm going to get to know you. But at the end of this meeting, I can assure you that you might say that we're not a good fit, and that's okay. But I have that decision as well, that probably I can encounter that we're not a good fit, and that's okay too. Okay, so when you put the rules like an upfront contract there, at the very beginning if it's going to go well. Yeah, Victor, but you have to sell. But yeah, quality sale is better than just a spot deal.
I think, yeah, what I hear there is, which is something which is counterintuitive to me as well, is like this idea of qualifying who you're selling with. That is often described as qualifying. And it's a counterintuitive, as an amateur salesperson, let's say, I would definitely try and almost close anyone vaguely interested in giving me any money. At the early days, for sure, I was chasing around, trying to think, how could I do that? And then you end up contorting yourself into trying to do things which you're probably terrible at. I remember I was certainly terrible at a couple of things that I tried to do. And then, but then it's counterintuitive to turn people away. Like, this is a thing that people don't get. When you're selling, you're supposed to be selling. You don't get this idea that you're qualifying. You're trying to make a fit so that the relationship lasts in the long term. And if you do that, I think people pick up on that. They value you more because they realize, okay, this person's really trying to deliver value. They're not just trying to get my invoice. And it's this, even funny enough, even in this podcast, like when I've been meeting with people who sometimes could be partners, I just put that out back in my mind. Because as soon as you start thinking about that, you forget about the value you're trying to deliver. You're trying to deliver value. That's the important thing. And you just, and once you do that, then you can get to the real common place, if you like. So I like it. And once you started, how did you find what was the effect of the Sandler system? Like, how has it helped you to build your business now? Was there a stage where you were also chasing every deal? And what's the difference now before the system and after the system?
No, actually, before reading the book and training myself into it, I was cold calling and whatever I had. And I was leaving money on the table because you went, let's say, I wanted to sell a life insurance or like whatever the best commission was, instead of nurturing a relationship and just doing a spot deal, you sold a life insurance and that's it. But when I started to do the system and apply the system, I started to, I don't want to sell that. I want to develop that relationship, that keep growing that client and make me, I don't know the word, but it that grow my practice in a better way. And in my subconsciousness, I was applying that system when I was golf caddying. And that's why I love that job, because after I read the book, let's say I go back to my caddy time. And when I was having good conversation during the 18 holes, that's when the biggest reward came in. And it wasn't just the tip or the money, is that guy, whenever come back, he called me in. Now, he didn't pick a random caddy. He said, I want Victor to be my caddy. Or he sent someone from New York coming here. And all of a sudden, look, I want Victor for my caddy. And people say, what? Because he caddy a friend of mine. So that developed the other businesses. No one likes to feel sold. No one. That's why the typical example is when you go to a car dealership. You know, you're going to end it up in a car that you don't need or spending too much money because you are feeling sold. I am following a guy that lives in Panama. He has the concept that we should be procurement assistant or purchase assistant. We are assistant, the guy that is not selling. We're not selling. We are helping them in the purchase. So when you're helping them in the purchase, they feel better, they feel they make the best decision, and they continue to, because you are advising them, not you are selling them. It's a matter of feeling, but it's quite a different.
Yeah, I get it. And at the end of the day, nothing happens until someone sells something. So it's important. Yeah. So maybe you could just tell me a bit now about, you figured out with the Sandler system who your ideal client is. Maybe you could tell us a bit more about exactly who you really fit well with.
Thank you for that question, because a lot of people say anyone can be my client. And when I hear this in my networking group and say, this guy doesn't have a clue, you need an ideal client. And in reality, let's say my ideal client is the company that is in the growth mode, okay, of $2 million revenue and up to 20 or 30 million dollars revenue. And why that range? Let's say when you are in the early six figures, you are still alone. You have to wear many hats and probably you are building up your team, but you cannot afford to have a CFO or COO. So that's the sweet spot for the fractional CFO. They don't have 10, 15 grand or whatever to pay, but probably they have $2,500, $3,000 to have someone there on a part-time to with experience to get them to reach out the goals, no? So that's the suite on the revenue side. I don't like the niche because, as I mentioned you early in this conversation, is that I am very curious. I like to learn from different industries, although my sweet spot is the food industry and the manufacturing part of basically the food industry, because I understand it very well. I spent 13 years in that industry from zero to top. No, so I, let's say that's my DNA, but I am open to help even an investor that has clinics or they have dental practices and they are expanding, but that they don't have a full-time CFO because they don't have the resources to have a full-time CFO, you know, because it doesn't make sense.
I think a fractional CFO, as I see it, is the most powerful hire you can make, between 2 and 10 million. So a lot of people wander into that revenue range and they've been maybe scrappy, they've maybe, you know, what it takes and so on. And they don't realize if you bring a fractional CFO, the amazing power that can be brought to the business. It's like a power up and people just don't realize it. I'm just working away here. And a fractional CFO can do something for you that no other hire can do at that rate and make a bigger impact in the business than any other hire. And part of the problem for that is fractional CFOs should learn to explain that better. And part of the problem is they don't realize in the first place. They think it's bookkeeping or whatever, but it's not. It's literally the difference between financial independence for your entire family and nothing. And it's just one hire. People don't realize that.
And that's true, because sometimes those $2 and $10 million revenue, they grew up so fast that they don't have the discipline. Yeah, they have a bookkeeper, they have an accountant, but that's what I don't do. What I try is to help them. Okay, now you need to do this strategic hiring of so-and-so of a team, or I'm working with a client right now and to dramatically change the sales comp of their employees, because it doesn't make any sense. But it helped them to grow at the scale, but it's the hen or the egg story, who come first. And I said, this is not making sense now, you have to change it. If someone wants to continue, they will continue in the boat. If not, people will leave, but you have to draw that line that you're here to make money, because at the end, we have to be those counselors of the consultant of those client that you're not here because you love to work. You want to be here because you are a business owner, not auto employee of your business. You know? So that's one of the things.
Okay, Victor, that's great. So maybe you could just wrap it up by telling us, how can people get in touch with you if they feel like they want to go a bit deeper?
Yeah, there are many ways. You can follow me on LinkedIn or with Compass Planning Group. My webpage is where I post tips and do a lot of my tips during the week. I also do my articles and blog. So the LinkedIn and my webpage are the best way to reach out.
Yeah, that's how we got in touch on LinkedIn. You confirm you're very active there. It's a good place to start. So thanks, Victor. And thank you for listening to the Gross Profit Podcast. If you're still here, your special reward is to be able to go to procurementexpress.com/partners. In there, I've created a webinar, which has two parts to it. First part is how fractional CFOs can better explain their value to sell to a CEO. And the second part is how other fractional CFOs are using Procurement Express to deliver value for their clients. So if you want to check that out, I'd appreciate it. Victor, you've been a star. I've really enjoyed this chat. Thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thank you.